Hello and welcome to the Marketing Meetup podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Today we have John Evans, the CCO of System One and the uncensored CMO, speaking all about, in an interview format, all about how his career has progressed and the different stories and traits and things that he needed to cultivate in order to get to what is undeniably a really impressive position. John came with great energy, great stories, and great enthusiasm to give generously over the course of this hour. So I really, really hope you enjoy it. I think whether you're junior, middle management or a more senior marketer, I think you can take something away from today's session. And I mean that sincerely. John was brilliant. It was a really fabulous episode. Last thing for me to do before we head over to the actual interview is a big thank you to this week's featured sponsor, who are Klaviyo. Klaviyo help you build automations, help you build unbelievable communications, help make your life a lot easier if you're an e-commerce marketer. They're an absolutely fabulous tailor-made platform for e-com marketers, and they do a really, really fabulous job at it. Klaviyo have been very generous in that they've donated to the community a calendar which has a bunch of dates, whether you're a junior marketer or a senior marketer or a mid-level marketer in any kind of organization. This calendar has these dates, and you can add it to your own Google Calendar, your Outlook calendar in one click, which makes it super easy to keep on track of what's going on in the world and how you can integrate that into your campaigns. Be sure to check out that resource via our newsletter too. With all that said, I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. I know that I did, and enjoy the practical takeaways. Take care. So let's start off, mate, with an obvious and quite big question, I think, which is, why marketing? What keeps you engaged?
Oh, why marketing? Well, it starts unusually in a meeting about tax. So I was... I originally studied finance and economics as my degree. I wanted to be a city banker, which may surprise a few people. And my first job was actually in the tax department of a big accountancy firm, and I was doing like personal tax for people. And I got bored, might surprise you, I got bored really quickly. Anyway, one of the meetings, I had to do the tax return for this particular guy, and he came in. And I was way more interested in his job than I was in his tax, you see. So we ended up chatting away. And I said, what is it you do? And he said, oh, I'm the marketing director for this big data business. And the more I got chatting, I went, oh, I really like the sound of what you're doing. And this might sound a bit trite, but what I decided was, I don't want to be counting the numbers. I want to be changing the numbers. And that was kind of the little epiphany I had. The trouble was, I'd got a degree in finance and economics. I got zero marketing experience. So the rather funny solution, which didn't go so well, was in my last year at university, I decided to apply for three jobs in marketing. And because I was a car nut, I applied for Mercedes-Benz was my like top job. And so this was a long time ago because there were photocopiers and stuff like that involved. But I got the ad for the new E-Class Mercedes, and I printed it out. But then I changed the copy to be describing me and why I was right for the job. So it was this, you know, elegant story about the E-Class, and I turned it into me. And I didn't hear back. And I was gutted. So, but the irony was, and this just goes to show how life is small. 20 years later, I'm delivering a marketing lecture to the board of Mercedes-Benz, and the HR director was in the room, and I told the story. I said, back in 1999, this young man, John, applied and didn't hear back. So at least I got to feedback anyway.
And did they remember? I mean, presumably.
No clue at all. No. They did what big corporate companies do and go inundated with applications every single year from so many people. We can't possibly reply to all of them. But, you know, there's a lesson there, isn't it? Like you have to be very persistent to get your first job. And I'm sure everyone listening has been in that situation where, you know, it feels like no one's listening.
100%. Oh, it's so true. It's so true. It's hard to get that foot in the door. I mean, that was a wonderful segue though as well, actually, because we can segue into your first job and say, could you describe your first job in marketing and what were the lessons that you still use today from that job?
Yeah, well, interestingly, so sort of going back to my career in finance, the difficulty I had to get into marketing was, how do you go from no experience to get into marketing? So I did a series of segues. So my very, very first job, I applied for it was called a category analyst. And this was back when businesses were investing in data for the first time, in Nielsen data to measure the market and to kind of grow the category and that kind of thing. And I went to work for Britvic Soft Drinks, and they liked the fact that I was analytical and that I had got a finance and economics degree. And I'd done econometrics as well. Econometrics was sort of this like rocket science back in the late 90s. Like, no one had heard of it sort of thing. And even though I felt like I was creative and wanted to go into the creative part of marketing, I had to start using the skill set that I had to try and solve a problem for the company. And then what I did is I kind of edged my way towards the brand marketing team. So I sort of started as a category analyst, then I jumped to trade marketing, then I sort of jumped to customer marketing, and then category marketing, and then eventually got my hands on the brand, but it took a while. And even when I did get my hands on the brand, I was still typecast as, oh, he's the numbers guy, so it does take a little while to, break out of your own stereotype.
Yeah, 100%. So was that actually something that you had in mind, I guess, putting yourself in the shoes of someone who may be listening today, or someone starting out their career? Did you go, branding is where I want to be? Did you have like a really clear sense of that?
Or... Yeah, I did. I think what I realized, and I think what I realized is what gave me energy is the invention side of marketing. So it's coming up with the idea, you know what I mean? And that's the bit that got me excited. So I'd be in like my analyst role, and my job was to kind of do the reports and write it all up and send it all out and that kind of thing. But actually what I loved doing was going, oh, I've got an idea for a new variant of Pepsi. Or what if we did a tango flavor like this? Or what if the advert had done that? And what I just noticed in myself was that's what made me light up. Yeah. And so I think, I sort of diagnosed that in myself to go, actually, the thing that's given me energy is the creation bit, the inventing new innovation or coming up with ideas for a campaign. Or it might be an in-store kind of, an in-store idea that kind of will help us sell more. But then, of course, the problem is, how do you go from something quite different to that? And so the one lesson I did learn was identify the need in the business and the skill set you have and try and solve it. And if you can do that, then you'll be successful and you'll be recognized. And then from there, you can kind of, you can kind of push yourself towards the end goal sort of thing. But it did take me a few steps, actually. And I mean, like many companies, they had this, this management program that some grads got to accelerate right past me, zoom past, straight into the plum jobs. I took a more meandering sort of like, having to, I was the underdog, so having to sort of, scrap my way to the end result.
That's so useful though. I mean, having that perspective of, I love that as a quote in itself. I mean, that's a great lesson. I've got Rebecca here in the chat who's saying, I work with marketing apprentices, so I'm here getting ideas for them. And like, that's a really nice sort of quotable quote, so to say, which is, my skill set plus company problem, how can we match the two of them? That's really thoughtful for someone who would have presumably quite young, at that stage, to sort of have that.
Well, it came, the insight came back again a few years later, because I was actually planning on leaving Britvic at the time. Right. And I went away on a sort of management away sort of 3 days on a course, and the same insight came up, and there were these two big circles, and it's like, what are the problems that Britvic need to solve? List them all. And we sort of did that in a big circle. And then on the other circle, it's like, where is your energy and where is your skill set? What things do you really enjoy? And then literally we had to sort of do this big overlapping exercise, which is like, where's the overlap? And I suddenly realized at that point, the thing I love doing and still love to this day is innovating. I love creating things and meeting kind of customer demands. And what I realized at that point in my career, I'd been at Britvic maybe 7-8 years, and I'd sort of got a bit bored. And what I realized is that Britvic had been successful innovation, but it had started to fail because it had too much of it. It had every single year, there was a brand new thing. And within 12 months, everyone had forgotten about the last thing and wanted the next thing. And I just saw this and went, because I'd been there long enough to see a few cycles, a few annual planning cycles. I was like, this is insane, because any other company would take any of the innovation from any year and go, that's the biggest thing we're going to do for the next 10 years. And honestly, you'd look at it and just go, that is going to be huge. but they gave up. I mean, in less than a year. I mean, they had 13 kind of launch cycles in a year, and you'd get one. So, you know, launch a new variant of Pepsi would have 4 weeks, right? Everyone would focus on for 4 weeks. And then the next week, the next one would be Robinson's. It would carry on. Anyways, that's how it works. So So what I did then is I then got really energized by, I'm going to solve this problem for the company, right? And this was like Friday afternoon. And bear in mind that this is like loads of post-it notes, scrappy pens. My handwriting's terrible as well, so it only makes sense. And I phoned the sales and marketing director. Now, bear in mind, I'm still quite junior, right? These are like the gods, you know what I mean? You know, that sit in on the mahogany tables in the boardroom that you on the 17th floor, you know? Anyway, so I thought, right, I phoned them both. And I said, I want breakfast 8 a.m. and I'm going to pitch an idea to you.
Wow.
And I'll tell you what, it was cold. It was raining. It was miserable. They were grumpy. And I turned up with these two flip charts going, that's what the company needs. That's what I'm brilliant at. I'm going to fix innovation. I had no plan. I just had that insight. And I thank them now because they kind of ran with it and said, okay, John, all right, well, we think you're onto something. I mean, you know, we recognize the same problem as you. Come back with a business case. Tell us how much it's going to cost. Tell us the resource you need. Tell us how you're going to do it. And then that was very generous of them because I didn't go with the answers. I went with the problem. And I think something you should always do is go with the answer. But within 3 months, I'd got a £6 million budget signed off, a team of 40, and a 50-50 joint venture with PepsiCo, our partner. And I was launching. It was almost the most scary moment of my career because it's that thing people say, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Because the moment, because what I'd done this sort of campaign with the board at the time, and I'd gone around each board member, and I said to each board member, tell me every single reason this will fail as an idea, right? And what I'd done is I'd taken really detailed notes and I'd literally thought through every answer to every question. Mm-hmm. When I went to the board meeting, I think I had 20 minutes. I mean, you don't get long at board meetings, right? Mm-hmm. So I went to the board meeting and I said, I've just answered every single question about why this will fail. I'm assuming, therefore, that I'm going to get yes. Now, it was a little bit of bravado on my part. But the CEO looked around at everyone and said, well, I assume that's the case, John. You've got the money. And therefore, I'm assuming this is going to be an enormous success because you've put the work in. Yeah. And I suddenly thought, I've got to do it. Because up to that point, it was theoretical. And then you go, oh, I've actually got to make this thing happen. And we had a plan to double, you know, the innovation every single year for the next 3 years. Now, fortunately, it did do that and it did work. But, oh, man, it wasn't without its bumps. So, yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, so, you know, some of the themes that I'm taking out from that anyone can take, you know, on any level in any company is about proactivity, is about insight generation, is about sort of going in and looking to solve the problem, is about identifying the problem and working it through. I mean, it strikes me that there's so much confidence that sort of came through there. And there's one of the questions actually in the Q&A from Lucy, who says, imposter syndrome. Do you feel confident in your own ideas when you have to defend it to upper management or even teams? Because, I mean, that at the early stage, that seems amazing. So, like, how did you even deal with that?
I know. There's a number of honest answers to that. There's a confident answer and then there's some honest answers. So one of the honest answers is I had to be prepared to leave the company. Right. Because I was right on the edge. I was literally on the edge thinking about phoning up headhunters and all that kind of thing. Right. Mm-hmm. So there has to be a motivation that if this doesn't work, I'm out. You've got to have that absolute desire that it must happen. If it's an optional thing, you won't do it because there's always a safer option. So I think part of it is going, right, I have to do this. Right. So I think the context was super important. And I think the other thing is that, again, I suffer from imposter syndrome and I have to sort of override myself and go, do you know what? What's the worst that can happen? If this does go wrong, and it could go wrong, and lots of things in my careers have gone wrong, by the way, so I could write a book on stuff that's gone wrong. You have to sort of remind yourself that, do you know what? We used to say at Breivik, we're only making fizzy pop, right? At the end of the day, we're not saving lives. We're just giving people an extra bit of refreshment through the drinks we make. So I think keeping that context is super important. And then the other thing that I find helps me personally is you actually build confidence by sharing an idea. And the more people you share the idea with, what happens is the more feedback you get, but the more validation you get that actually it's a good thing. And right. we're all different. We find our energy in different places. But I found actually weirdly going to the board, each member and going, tell me why this will fail, actually for me was the thing that gave me confidence. So I maybe started with a 20% chance of success, but I probably ended at 80% chance of success because I'd gone through that kind of process and getting feedback. And the other thing I'd say as well is hire really well and choose your boss really well, because people get this wrong. People go, I want to work for this company because it's brand X. I want to work on Ben and Jerry's. I don't know, whoever, right? You go, I love that brand. The way more important thing is who do I want to work for and who do I want to work with? And actually, I think if you've got the right team of people around you and the right support structure, I think that's going to help you address imposter syndrome. But ultimately, it never goes away, right? Because I've had some degree of it all my life, you know what I mean? And people go, surely you can't because you host a podcast and you get on stage. And it's like, don't believe that. Honestly, don't believe that. Don't assume that confidence on the stage means you don't have an imposter syndrome, you know?
Yeah, 100%. Mate, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing it. And just to back up a shared feeling, then imposter syndrome does indeed never go away. bang on. Thank you for that. And I love that thought. It would probably be a theme that sort of comes throughout your answers, I would suspect, which is bringing other people on the journey. Because as you say, you know, it has so many benefits in so many different ways, whether it's imposter syndrome or getting people to buy into your projects or whatever it is, then presumably having more people, you know, it takes it off your shoulders.
I would honestly, like, if I started my career again, I'd write my CV and my career aspirations based on the people I want to work with, not the companies I want to work for. And it sounds a bit weird, but it's the people. Your boss is the biggest determining factor of your success. Have they got your back? Do they want you to succeed? Can they coach you? Do they believe in you? Do they back you when you fail? All those questions are actually the questions to ask of a new job, right? And almost no one does, right? So in a way, you should feel when you're interviewing for a job as much right to ask those questions and do your due diligence as well. Go and interview people that work with that person and go, you know, when you faced at some moment a crisis, have they got your back? You know, do they praise you? You know, do they give you constructive, you know, do they help, you know, coach you and that kind of thing? And that's rare, but yeah, try and do that, because that ultimately will get you further quicker.
100%, mate. A wonderful answer. Thank you so much. Like that's another quote of a quote. You're nailing this. So thank you. let's take one of the questions, because it struck me that it was bang on for this sort of beginning stage of people's careers. It comes from Richard actually, who says, do you think generalists are better placed than specialists to develop into a senior role? It seems to me that to oversee all of marketing, you need to have a fairly good understanding of the entirety. So, like, while you may not be able to answer for everyone, what was your decision when you were like, oh, I'm going to become a specialist, or I'm going to become a generalist, when you were sort of thinking about your wider career?
Yeah, I've always defaulted to generalist. I think weirdly, my last 4 years, I've been working in a mega specialism, which is advertising, innovation, testing and development sort of thing. And honestly, I really enjoyed it actually, because my career has been as a complete generalist. Yep. And actually I've really enjoyed the confidence that comes from really knowing something in detail. You know, being the best person in the room at subject matter X or Y is actually a really confidence giving thing. So I'm not going to try and say one is better than the other, because actually I've seen the benefit of, you know, being super skilled at one particular thing. And actually I sort of wish I knew then what I know now about creative development, for example, right? I would have made way better ads, you know, in my career, had I known what I know now. Anyway, so definitely big plug for, you know, specialism can be very good. And also, if you can become an expert in the field, then you become successful in a different way, because you become the guru, the expert, and you get opportunities that you wouldn't as a generalist. So definitely a big plug for that. Me personally, I the thing that I get energy from is actually seeing things happen and joining the dots together. I naturally kind of go, well, if that did that and that person did that and we came together and we went for that and we did it in this way. So that's how my mind works. I kind of knit everything together, and I like having a vision for where a business can go. And I think probably most CMO, well, I think it was when I was interviewing Ritson, actually, he said the CMO is rarely the best marketer on the team, but they're probably the best, political person or whatever. And that's probably true, actually. So the skill set that makes you great as a CMO is not the skill set that makes you great as a specialist. They are really, really, really different. And it's quite a tough thing to get your head around. And when you make, sometimes you find people that are just absolutely amazing specialists, right? And they never make that jump because it's just too big a bigger shift sort of thing. So I think generally probably most CMOs are probably generalists. I mean, occasionally you get CMOs that are particularly good at communication or they're particularly good at innovation. They've become famous for that. But I reckon overall it's probably the generalist.
That's really interesting. So just to pick up on that point with Ritson, would you say that there's anything you would be encouraging folks at a sort of more junior position who aren't CMOs presently, any skill sets that you'd be promoting them to try and cultivate at this stage in their career? Or should they just be focusing on doing the job,
I think, well, there's a number of things. I think that the thing you realize when you get to CMO level is actually there's loads of things you actually discover, but fundamentally you're there to lead the commercial success of the business. So you're there to deliver financial results, you're there to deliver growth, you're there to deliver strategy, and therefore understanding how the entire business works is actually really important. So I think the most successful junior marketers that I've seen are the ones that will do the cross-functional projects. They'll get involved in launching a change program or innovation or things that require them to understand different parts of the business or create the business case for a new product launch, understand the P&L. The more you understand how business works and how decisions are made and so on, I think the more effective you'll be when you scale up.
Nice. That's perfect. Thank you so much, mate. I think so much of what you're speaking about, and maybe it's my personal bias showing through here because it's one of my personality traits that I really value, but it's proactivity, sort of taking a little bit of control one way or observing and sort of saying I can help. A lot of that seems to be coming through with your answers, which I adore. I really, really love. So thank you. This is really, really helpful. Let's take it to sort of the management sort of portion of your career, because I want to spend a decent amount at the CMO sort of level, because that's where a lot of the questions are coming through as well. So can you share, and it's a bit of a change of pace, but can you share a challenging situation you faced as a manager and how you handled it? And what did this lesson and experience teach you? Cool.
I think the first time I became a manager, probably 3 or 4 years into Britvic, I think it's when I first became a budget holder that and you're no longer just doing the delivery, you're actually responsible for budget. And I remember this also links back to my innovation sort of idea, is that there's a thing in FMCG, they call them dump bins. Now this is going to sound about five people on the call have gone, yes, we know what he's talking about. Everyone else, what he's talking about. But like when you go into like a convenience store, you have this like cardboard bin, right? And they put whatever's on promotion in that cardboard bin. And I just thought it's the ugliest, worst way, particularly in drinks, because drinks are supposed to be chilled, they're supposed to be nicely laid out, they're supposed to be eye level, just by level. There's a load of stuff that makes drinks sell, right? Putting them ambiently in a bin in the corner of the shop is not a good look, right? Anyway, so I came up with this reinvention of the dump bin into what's called a shipper unit. Sorry, again, only two people now on the call. I know what he's talking about. But imagine like this cardboard sort of shelving that looks attractive, and it's almost like creating an extra shelf by the shelf. Anyway, that's kind of idea. And this supplier had said he would design me the dump bin, the shipper unit, for the same price as the dump bin. And anyway, I'd gone out to our sales team and I said to the whole sales team, I'm launching the UK's first ever shipper unit. And it was genuinely, I know it sounds a bit funny, it was actually breaking news at the time. And you realize, by the way, when you're in a particular industry, you get excited about stuff and everyone else is going, it's a bit of cardboard, mate. Honestly, it's not that big.
I love this.
Anyway,
it's great.
This was a big deal at the time, right? And I was proudly proving myself in my first management job. Anyway, it's sort of like the way it used to work is each of the sales teams would then order it on behalf of their customers and they'd put it in store. Anyway, the orders were literally about 10 times what they were supposed to be. And the supplier had lied to me and the cost was three times the cost of a dump bin, right? Mm. So I had this tiny little budget, this dump bin budget, right? I can't remember, it was like 15, 20,000 pounds. And then the bill came in, it was like 150 grand. Mm. And I thought I was gonna have to resign. And I remember I went to my boss and I was shaking like a leaf. And it was the first management job I'd had, the first time I'd been in charge of a budget. And literally my very first moment trying to be the clever one that did this big innovation, I'd blown the budget so far that it was even breaking the overall brand team budget. We're now overspent because of my little thing I'd done. Anyway, so it had this knock-on effect and I was absolutely terrified. Anyway, my boss, Paul, one of the best bosses ever, he just asked me this question: how much more did we sell because of your shipper unit than we would have done in your dump bin? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. Anyway, we worked out it was literally hundreds of thousands of pounds extra sales was a result of what came out. All I could see was the cost, right? But he brilliantly, again, it's a good leadership thing in terms of having the back of your team, but just reframing it into what you did there was invest in something. And he also said the other thing, which was, bless him, such a lovely thing to say, not only did it help us sell a lot more, but it also created a new way of displaying products in store. And that became the standard that we then adopted. So the dump bin literally got dumped forever and we switched this new shipper unit style. Right. And that became the norm. So every time we had a promotion, which is every 4 weeks, it was quite a regular thing to do. But every 4 weeks, then suddenly my design of shipper unit became the standard one the company used. But honestly, I thought I was getting fired, yeah. You know, because I just overspent this. But now, of course, I learned about, make sure you've got quotes in writing, make sure things are clear, that, you know, don't trust suppliers just because they say, you know, be clear about when you're ordering, you put a limit on it if it needs a limit. I mean, the lessons are endless, aren't they? But actually the thing I will always be grateful for is having a boss that helped me reframe a problem into a solution.
That's bang on. Oh, mate, what a story. I can imagine. I felt the emotions come through as you were telling it. I can relate. I mean, we've got Paula in the chat saying, love it on the reframing. We've got Rebecca who's just celebrating with yay.
Oh, thank you. I can feel the emotion now. It's still raw. It's like it was 20 years ago.
Oh, bless you. No, that's tough, but what a wonderful lesson. And I guess, you know, at this stage where we're sort of speaking about your sort of management experience, there is a lovely question that's actually in the chat feature, which is, I'm curious to know what's your leadership style. And I'd be interested to layer on to your leadership style, like whether that's changed over the course of time, whether there's been stuff that's changed.
I can give you a very up-to-date answer to that because... So probably one of the most inspiring bosses I ever had. So after my dump bin episode, I then moved to one of the most exciting times of my career, actually at Britvic, in the international part of the team. And I've never had so much fun. It was great. We were basically exporting drinks around the world. We were creating distribution agreements. We were creating launch campaigns. Anyway, it was brilliant. It was one of those training ground roles where I got to do everything. You know, what actually one of I think things I've been blessed with is taking on a smaller role early in your career can be a real accelerant because in a small, I mean, smaller as in prestige or budget, because you get to manage everything quickly rather than being, I'm one of 10 people on a brand team. You become the brand team, right? And that was kind of me. So it was a really, really good experience. And then, the Clark, who was my boss at the time, was easily one of the most inspirational people I worked for. And he said this question to me when I left. He said, did you ever feel at any point in the last 3 years that I ever overrode you in terms of decision? And I went, do you know what? I don't think you ever did. And he said, then my work here is done. He said, I wanted you to know every single step that it was okay for you to try and fail because I knew you would learn more by doing that. And I never ever wanted to kind of, you know, pull the rug or stop you doing something, but I always wanted you to know that you would absolutely have my back. I'd have your back at every step of the way. And that was so powerful, because going back to the imposter syndrome thing we talked about earlier, knowing that it's okay if it doesn't go well actually gives you permission to probably be more successful than you otherwise be. Otherwise, you're always playing it safe and repeating what you always did. But actually, I did some of the most successful marketing during that period and had some great success. But I did it from a position of knowing that I was being backed. And that was amazing. So to answer your question, that was such a like profound moment for me. I've always wanted to be Clark, you know what I mean? So I've always carried the what would Clark do kind of in my head, and always wanted to kind of hopefully inspire, protect, and back everybody that kind of has ever been in my team. Now, here comes the lesson. That's not necessarily what everybody else wants. It's what I want. And a very recent profound lesson I've learned literally in the last 2 weeks, having got some 360 degree feedback on my leadership, is just because that's how I want to be managed does not mean it is how other people want to be managed. And what I've learned is I'm unusual. So I love the freedom. I love risk taking. I love to be able to go and, you know, kind of take the big jumps. And I love a boss that supports me. But actually, for a lot of people, what they want is a clear decision. They want clear timings. They want to know the parameters. They want to know the process by which things are doing. They want to know the principles by which we should operate. And actually, even today, I'm learning to try and combine those two things together. Actually, try and understand the guardrails that other people would like to operate in to create the harmony and effectiveness and that kind of thing, as well as doing what I think everyone wants is like a big motivational speech and permission to, you know, take a jump sort of thing. So I think the most profound lesson is what works for you doesn't necessarily work for the people you manage. Nice. And that's taken me a long time to learn.
That's fabulous. It's so important. And I appreciate it's super recent, so you may not have even had time to put this into action beyond having the thought, but how are you starting to approach finding out that stuff
I actually put it into action immediately, actually. And it's funny that I suppose before my default would be, obviously, you know what you want to do, and obviously, you know, people should be left alone to go and do it. But actually what I'm doing now is when I'm making a decision, I'm communicating it proactively. So in other words, even if the decision is not a decision yet. So what I mean is, for example, if I'm working on something and I know that in 3 weeks' time we're going to be launching a new policy on something or a new thing, right? I try not to be too specific about it. Anyway, something new is being done in three weeks' time, right? My default before would be surprise them in 3 weeks, right? Yeah. I'd be, da-da, this is amazing. Right? And then instead, I just go, dear everyone, this is the roadmap to 3 weeks' time. We're doing this week, this next week, this next week. So the reason we're doing it is because of this. And the things we have to land between us are these things. And I got a lovely email back from someone going, oh, this is amazing. And I'm like, it's not amazing. It's just me telling you what I'm working on. And yet for people that I'm leading, if I don't do that, there's a void, isn't there? There's a void of what's going on. And when there's a void, people love to fill it, and they tend to fill it with the worst outcomes, not the best outcomes. You know, I tend to be an eternal optimist. I'm going, of course we're going to be successful. It's going to be amazing. And yet most people are sitting there going, oh, this is going to be a disaster because I've not heard anything. And if I've not heard anything, it must be terrible, you know. Anyway, so I'm learning to communicate even when there's not anything new to say, but there's at least talking about the journey we're going on and when we're going to make a decision and how we're going to make the decision becomes as important.
I love that. Well, we've got Anna in the chat saying over communicating for the win, and Claire who says internal comms so easily forgotten when the fun things are happening, but it's bang on. So thank you for sharing
that. I'm learning that, and look, you know, as a podcast host you'll get this, but I love the external comms. It gives me a real buzz. Yeah, and I need to apply that skill set internally as much as I do externally, so you know, thank you for everyone on the chat saying that.
You're definitely getting the validation here, which is really nice. Let's take the question from Alice that sat at the top of the Q&A right now. And the one thing I'd do for folks watching in today is if you see a question in the Q&A that you really like, particularly down the bottom, make sure to give it a thumbs up so I can make sure to prioritize it. We've got like 23 minutes left, and we're going to do this last question on management before we segue into the CMO sort of section. But I would love to make sure that we prioritize the questions that you want answering too. So this last question in the sort of management section comes from Alice, who says, what would be the number one piece of advice you have for showing senior leadership you are capable of progressing and taking on a managerial role? And I think this is probably either a managerial or taking the step up into CMO.
Ooh, I love that. It's a really good, cool question. I would say, and for your first job, so think about when you're writing a brand plan, right? What's the first thing you do? Understand the consumer, right? So use that skill set, and a bit like I was saying with my board earlier, understand what is important to senior management. Mm-hmm. And I'm gonna make a bet with you, you will be surprised, and it may not be what you think, right? So if you were to go to senior management and say, look, I just want 20 minutes for a coffee, that's being proactive. Very few people do that. So the first thing to do is get to know your senior management just by offering a coffee. Make it easy at breakfast, being the day, end of the day, whatever. Ask them what's keeping you awake at night, or what's the biggest single business problem you're here to solve, or what's the one thing our department are not doing that they should be doing. Right? Those a few questions like that, you will learn something, I promise. Because senior management, like me, are very bad, as you just heard, at saying what's on their mind, right? And it'll often surprise you because you go, hang on the company wall, we've said these are our pledges and these are our strategies. And then you'll talk and go, well, actually, we're worried because we might be getting taken over by another company next week. You know, something will pop up, or actually, we're not innovating in the way we used to, which was the Britvic example, right? You'll learn something quite profound. Now, then what you can do is, the art to this thing is then whatever you want to do or wherever you're positioning, reverse yourself into that. So that when you're presenting to senior management, you go, I recognize one of the biggest challenges in our business today is this, right? Suddenly you've got their attention and you've demonstrated something so important, which is I know what drives this business and I know what this business is trying to do. I promise that just that one thing will put you on the radar. And I think we touched on this question earlier, but so few people manage up, right? And I can't tell you as a leader, it is like manna from heaven when someone puts their hand up and goes, I've spotted a problem and here's a solution. And do you know what? I'm going to take care of it for you. And honestly, as a leader, you go, oh, it's like one less thing to worry about. And suddenly that person, I promise you, in the eyes of management, that person is just like walking on water. So be that person that goes, I know the problem, here's a solution, and I'm going to show you. And look, I suppose I could have said, you know, demonstrate your skills and come up with 10 reasons why. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think that's mostly the thing. So be seen and show that you understand the problem and be proactive and you know, suggesting a possible answer, even if it doesn't involve you. I mean, even if you just want to be the cheerleader that says, do you know what, it'd be great if our customer service team did things like this, and I'm going to get my agency to come and do an inspiration day, and we're going to come up with ideas, and we're going to give them fluffy toys, whatever it is. But but even if you're just the person that kind of facilitates it, you'll just be seen as proactive. And proactivity versus reactivity is probably the biggest differentiator between kind of management and leadership.
Bang on. I love that. And so James, my co-founder in the chat, has picked up on one of your lines there, which is, let me take care of that for you. It's such a powerful line. We've got Alice.
Be loved forever.
100%. Honestly, 100%. I, you know, as someone who is supposed to be a leader in my business, you know, like having someone just do a thing. Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to mirror that because it's so useful. So thank you.
And one small addendum thought actually is, and I know this is super true of me, is don't assume that leaders have everything sorted, right? Leaders are making it up. Yeah. Leaders have weak spots. Leaders worry. Leaders have imposter syndrome. Leaders are, you know, have got personal crisis going on in their lives. I mean, there's a ton of things. Almost think, and leaders have a level of pressure that might surprise you as well in terms of results and all sorts. So don't underestimate how powerful that is, because, you know, try and see the leader not as this untouchable God, you know, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. If you see them as kind of individuals just like you that are struggling to, you know, drop the kids off and make it into work on time, you know, they are human. So, yeah, don't forget that.
That's really reassuring. Thank you so much for that. There's a great deal of humility that comes through with those statements, so it's appreciated. Let's segue into CMO land, as we officially call it now. So you touched on it earlier, but I want to ask it openly. What does a CMO actually do? You know, how do you fill your day to day? And is, I guess, maybe a more interesting question is, did any elements of what a CMO does actually surprise you versus what your perception was of the role?
A lot surprised me. The first surprise was the first time being on a board, because if you think about it, you spent your entire career doing marketing, being with marketers, debating things and talking a language that no one else speaks, right? Then you get to the boardroom. And in my first board meeting, the marketing section was 20 minutes at the end of an 8-hour day, right? And literally it was in the last 20, it was almost like, and finally, John's new labels, you know, it'll be, and you suddenly realize where you are in the pecking order. And you know, so we, you know, in the particular board I joined, we were talking about company debt. We were talking about a legal suit against us. We were talking about factory efficiency. We were talking about capital investment. We were talking about selling the business. We were talking about the Christmas party, whatever. The stuff that gets talked about at the board is really not much marketing, right? So if you think about that, you need to come prepared with a point of view. You're no longer you're not the best marketer in the team. You are the representative of the marketing department. It's subtly different, right? You're there to represent marketing, but you're also a member of a commercial leadership team. That mm-hmm. means that you're there to kind of do company strategy, do employee engagement, do crisis management. What happens if the factory burns down? I mean, I've been in those situations, like where the factory's broken down and we can't produce for 6 weeks. What do we do? As the marketing director, I can go, well, that's not my job, is it? I mean, like, I'm designing the labels, or whatever it might be. No. You are in the factory. You're figuring it out. You're trying to get, trying to get the team out of the solution. You're trying to think, how do we communicate to customers and tell them they've got no stock, all that kind of stuff, right? And it's quite a profound difference. And as I say, the skills that got you to there aren't the skills that keep you there. So that's the first thing. So, and then, I mean, I kind of joke about the CMO has six P's. There's the four P's, which the team does, by the way. The two P's you need are politics and persuasion. So you need to represent marketing, which means you, in order to get permission to do the marketing that the company needs to do, you then need to talk in a language you've not talked in before. So you need to talk in terms of finance, return on investment, business case, how it's going to improve employee engagement. Suddenly you're talking, you need to position things in a way that everyone else around the room goes, oh yeah, now they're talking my language. Right. You go there and just talk about, I don't know, engagement on Instagram, like, what you're going to get is you're going to get the chairman's granddaughter sort of, syndrome thing. You know what I mean? Where they go, oh yeah. No, I've heard of that. My grandkids are always talking to me about that. You end up in that everyone's got an opinion about the campaign type thing. Mm-hmm. What you need to be doing is thinking, how does this marketing idea transform our business? And how do I put it in a language in a way that are going to demonstrate it's going to make us more money, it's going to make us more successful, it's going to make our employees prouder, it's going to make the factory more efficient, et cetera, et cetera. We're not going to waste all these labels because John's changed the labels again. I'd go, love, this is what happens, right? I'm joking, it's not too far from the truth, but you go, look at my shiny new labels, everyone. And you know what happens? Operations director, we've got £20,000 worth of old labels, John, what are we going to do about that? Finance director, the new labels are 50% more expensive per unit. You're adding 1p a cost per case, which is going to mean we're going to miss our target. And the sales director is going to go, well, the supply chain's so useless, it won't be on shelf for 6 weeks. This is what happens, right? And then anyway, sorry, I'm going on about labels.
It's good.
You realize the conversation is different, right? And you need to be prepared for that difference conversation. And so politics and persuasion. And the politics is, I hate politics, by the way. I loathe it. I've come a cropper to politics, but there's an element at which you do need to understand how an organization makes decisions, understand, what everyone's incentivized on, and just make sure that you're positioning the role of marketing to deliver against the company, which is probably the thing. And the other obvious point, sorry to say this as well, which I know is obvious, but I need to be reminded, is you are leading others, you're not doing the job. And that is one of the most profound, difficult things to get your head around, because suddenly the art of enabling, supporting, coaching, giving permission to others versus your instinct, by the way, if you're anything like me, your instinct is screaming, I know the right answer. It's the red one, not the blue one. And then you've got your head of marketing going, and here's the case for the blue one. And you're like, what do I do? Do I override them? Do I support them? Do I let them make the mistake? If you know, they might be right, you know, what kind of thing? Do we go to research? You know, what do we do? Anyway, those things, again, as a manager, you kind of go, you don't realize how difficult it is being the leader when you're being presented with stuff that isn't what you would do it or how you'd do it, and how do you deal with that? So that's a definite.
Do you still consider yourself a marketer? Like, with everything you've sort of expressed there, you know, sort of, you are the chief marketing officer. I know that isn't your current title anymore, you know, but it's still the same. Or do you consider yourself a manager or a director, or CXO? And that's just like a completely different job, because it feels like it's a linear progression, but what you're describing actually feels like something completely different, you know, not even.
I agree. It's really interesting, actually, that we need to avoid the rabbit hole that is the marketing title, the CMO title, which is a whole nother day's work. But what do people see as marketing in an organization is a really interesting question, because you go to some businesses and marketing is kind of like making the brochures for the trade show, right?
Yeah.
In other companies, marketing is the entire strategy of the entire business in terms of the proposition, the pricing, how you go to market, what you're going to do, how you're going to make money, et cetera, et cetera. And I've always believed that marketing is that. One of my favorite marketers is Richard Branson, for example, right? And people go, well, he's not a marketer, John. And I go, well, of course he is. He's one of the world's best marketers. Personal brand, business brand, unbelievable. You know what I mean? And as marketers, we should be strategy and execution. And yet I think people see marketing as somehow the end of the funnel, the last little bit, because it's the comms or it's the PR or it's the packaging. And that's the end. That's not that's not where it starts. So if you define marketing in the way I define it, I've always been marketing, but I think some people would go, it appears to be commercial, or it's business change or business transformation. You might be a sort of a better title.
Interesting. No, that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. I want to go a little bit more tactical and pick up on a few questions from the community as we come into our last 10 minutes. Mate, you've been fantastic so far, so thank you very much. We've got a question from Anonymous who says, I'm due to start a new head of level role in 2 to 3 weeks. I'd love John's thoughts on how to best go about making an impact early on, and general thoughts on what to do when you're starting a new marketing role. And I guess specifically the context here is sort of early days in a leadership position.
Well, someone who works for me has just finished her first 30 days, and I loved what she did. So she actually committed not to make a decision in the first 30 days. Nice. Instead, she did an intense customer listening exercise where she went to our customers, she went to our internal customers, people that use our products, et cetera, et cetera. And she just listened, wrote down as much as she could, absorbed. And at the end of it, she's come out with the most brilliant set of observations about how, now, all of the things I probably knew were true, but having somebody kind of, just have that fresh perspective of like, she's able to go, I've never worked with this team before. I'm coming from a very different, organization. And the clarity of thinking in her first 30 days was just something you never, ever, ever get again. And although it might sound brave to go, I'm not going to actually make a decision or actually deliver anything for 30 days, what it means is she's now set up for the next 3 or 5 years. If you go in straight away and just go, I'm just going to respond, and I'm going to pretend I know and all that kind of thing, that's when you get unstuck. So I think, listen in the first 30 days will actually make you so much more powerful. And maybe at the end of 30 days, if you're bold enough to do this, right, tell people that's what you're going to do, mm-hmm. and actually commit to, in 30 days time, I'm going to present back my 30-day findings with a set of recommendations for how I'm going to be successful in this job. And I want everybody to coach me back on, like, tell me how I make stuff happen in this organization, tell me how I'll be successful and all that kind of thing. It sounds ballsy, but I think if you did something like that, people go, wow. And you'd probably be seen as someone who's made a real difference in the first 30 days. Nice. I think that's what I do.
That's incredible, mate. And I love also that you've brought in themes of the over-communication, or, you know, just frankly, communication.
Yeah.
And the proactivity in addition, you know, and so some of the questions in the Q&A that we may not ask explicitly, but are actually sort of implied with your answers, is that, you know, we're coming back to those traits around sort of proactivity, communication, management, all of it is there in that answer. Yeah. So thank you very much. It's bang on. We've got James in the chat saying that's such good advice, with such in capital letters. So there you go. we'll take the next question from Sarah, because I think it's something that sits in some people's minds when looping in the question around the imposter syndrome as well, to a certain extent, which is, what's your advice about moving from head of marketing to CMO? I see a lot of talk about stuff like MBAs, but is this really needed? So like on the qualifications front and stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was starting out, there really were very few qualifications. So most of it was learning on the job, or sometimes I was fortunate enough to work for some business where they had internal marketing programs. I worked for First Drinks, which was owned by Bacardi, and there's Bacardi management program. So I've been fortunate, I think, in the early stage of my career to be on some reasonably decent kind of marketing programs. I personally am not a fan of the full-time MBA, go away and get, you know, 2 years of, you know, work out at Harvard. Mm-hmm. Only because I don't think I've really seen that work in marketing. Now, I've seen it work in management consultancy. Like, management consultancy is full of MBAs. I mean, literally, it's, you know, where actually your job is to be theoretical, you know, and turn up with the, you know, McKinsey report on the future of, you know, future of sustainability or whatever. But I think marketing is so much of an applied science that actually I love, for example, Ritson's mini MBA, things like that. I also love the amount of books that are written on marketing. I mean, the first thing I did in every marketing job I've ever done with the teams I've led is I've handed out a number of books to them and said, right, get your head around this. It will literally save you in a difficult time. And I think with marketers, there's obviously podcasts, but there's so many books, there's Ritson's MBA. You can actually learn a huge amount while you're on the job. And I think that's, if it were me, again, it's only an opinion. So someone else might tell you that MBAs are the future. But for me, I think those 2 years spent reading the right books, doing things like Ritson's course, stuff like that, will probably get you further.
Nice. Well, you've dropped the book bomb here, because folks in the chat are now asking, what books, John?
So yeah. No, good question. Okay, so may surprise you, may not surprise you. The non-surprising book is How Brands Grow. So obviously, you know, Byron's book on that is not faultless, but it has a lot of the fundamentals of marketing that I think will surprise you. And you just need to know in terms of penetration and loyalty and mental and physical availability, right? So I think as a foundational text, that's super good. So always start there. I love books. So for me, I'm a massive challenger. So Adam Morgan's Eat Big Fish, or the better one, actually, sorry to be controversial, his second book, not nearly as successful, is called The Pirate Within. Nice. The Pirate Within is about how to be a challenger within an organization. And it was literally my manual for many, many years, because actually what most of us are not the startup founder, right? Most of us are in big organizations or small organizations, but we're one of the team. And therefore his second book actually is written to those people. So that's actually amazing. The third book is called The Founder's Mentality. Again, it's a massively underrated book. It's looking at founder-led businesses versus management-led businesses. And again, it's a little known thing, this, but founder-led businesses on the stock market way outperform management-led businesses. Mm-hmm. And they unpick the reasons why that's the case. But the reasons for that are things like, you know, the mentality you have as a founder, the frontline focus, they call it, the fact that you're close to your customer, the fact that you obsess about the quality of execution. I've seen in my career that what they describe as being precisely the behaviors that make you successful. And it's one of those things that we don't talk about in marketing. We don't talk about how good is the execution, right? We don't talk about how much time do you spend with your customers rather than with your internally. Those things matter. They really matter day to day, and they make a huge difference. They make you a better marketer. But I've never heard that talked about very much, and yet they nail the evidence for that and the toolkit. So they would be the top three books that I've rotated it a bit, but usually they'd be the three books.
Amazing. That's so, so good. Thank you, mate. Well, we've got folks repeating them in the chat, but we'll also, there is a LinkedIn carousel waiting to happen with John
Eppington's
top three book recommendations.
When you do a LinkedIn post on my top 10 books, they always do really well. There's a definite appetite for
100%.
Kind of like the best books.
It's the standard webinar question.
We need to write a book about the best books, don't we? I think that would like trump everything.
100%.
John and Joe's best book guide.
I need to start reading. Let's take two last general questions and then we'll wrap up. So John, you've been great so far, and thank you everyone as well in the community for your wonderful questions. So the first of the last two questions are general questions, but what is the best piece of career advice that you've ever received, and why has it been particularly impactful on your career?
I remember meeting years ago the managing director of Gallup, and back, this is long, long time ago, but they were just working on a thing called Strength Finders. And what they understood, which is the most important, that basically people operate best when they play to their strengths. Now, I know this is going to sound so obvious, but if you think about every bit of personal development and every bit of feedback you get at work, it's 90% negative, right? It's basically your development plan. Mm-hmm. Even the word development suggests that you're not good enough and that you need to focus on things that you're not good at, right? Anyway, what they discovered is that actually the best way to develop is to focus on your strengths. Because when you focus on your strengths, the reason why that's important is your strengths give you energy, and your energy gives you belief. And when you're high on belief, you're more able to address your blind spots, right? So they always say coach from position of strength. You say, so I would say, think about what you're really good at and build a career doing that, because it will give you energy, you'll go faster, and you're better able to complement your weaknesses. I mean, I don't even want to use the word weakness, because actually weaknesses are sometimes overdone strengths, right? Some of the things I'm not good at are actually because I'm really good at something else. You know what I mean? And no one is perfect at everything, you see. And it's much better reframing to find the things that you're strong at, because they'll give you energy, you'll go faster, you'll be more successful. So I think that would be it.
I love that. We've got a very enthusiastic comment here from Laura, who says this in capital letters: why not become experts at what you're good at instead of being better at the things you're
not? It sounds so obvious, but the problem is, maybe I picked the wrong companies, but I've been in so many businesses where you've got the 360 degree development plan, and it's just this avalanche of things that you should be better at. And I'm just going, oh my God, I can't do this.
That's bang on, mate. Let's take the last question. Because we've made it 1:30 and you've been so useful. So thank you. I suspect I might know two of these words, and it could just be a 3-word answer, maybe. But the question is, what are the top three qualities you believe are essential for anyone aspiring to reach a senior leadership position in marketing?
I would say number one is vision. And the reason I say that is your job, more than any other C-suite role, more than any other person in your team, is there to set the direction that you're going in and to inspire everyone in the direction you're going. And maintaining that course is incredibly hard. But what I realized, and this is quite tough, is if I don't do it, no one else will. Or if I don't do it, they'll do it in a way that's not right. I don't mean that arrogantly, but I mean, otherwise the finance department will go, right, we need to make more money. You know what I mean? Or the operations, we need to be more efficient, right? In the absence of you setting the direction and vision, other people will make it up and it won't be the stuff you want to do, right? Anyway, so own the vision. Own the vision would be number one. So start with that. The second bit of advice would be hire very, very well. And I know there's this trite thing about is it Branson that said, hire people better than you and get out of the way?
Yeah, well, many people. Yeah.
Yeah, success has many fathers. I'm sure that's the truth to lots of people. But there's an element of truth in that. Well, I like to hire people not in my likeness. I love to hire people that are different to me that can do stuff I can't do. I find that energizing. But really think about who you hire. I've come unstuck by not facing into some people challenges and not necessarily hiring the very, very best. So it's tough, but you're better waiting for absolute, you know, superstars, and build a team that trust each other and are going to work together rather than fight each other. And then the third thing is probably, which I'm still working on, is learn how to deliver through other people. Because if you can become the constraint, and I've learned this myself, I can become a constraint. If I want to do it in my way, then I'm limited to my capacity. Find ways to build, train, put in place, you know, hire well, all the things that enable growth to happen through other people so that you can actually get out of your own way, which is hard for people like me. Because I find that hard.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say if I admire, I don't know, some of the CMOs I've had on my show who are running billion, multi-billion dollar organizations, mm-hmm. they have had to learn how to make things happen through other people. So yeah, if you can do that, you can go on.
Bang on. Mate, that's been an hour full of so much good stuff. So thank you very, very much for sharing as you have today. It's been super useful and very generously given. So thank you for sharing the My thoughts pleasure. In the brain and your experiences. And thank you as well to everyone in the community for your great questions and also for your lovely chat messages throughout the duration. It's really appreciated, and I hope you've enjoyed it too. We've got a lot of thank yous coming through right now, John. So
thank you for having me.
With all that said, we'll be back next Tuesday for another topic. We've got a world adventurer coming to speak all about how to turn up at work, which would be great fun. Also, don't forget to check out the Uncensored CMO as a podcast, well worth listening to. And also a big thank you to our sponsors this week. This week's featured sponsor is Klaviyo. So a big thank you to them and the rest of our sponsors too. With all that said, I hope you have a really lovely day. Thank you for taking the time with us today. And we'll see you very, very soon. Cheers. Take care.
Thank you. Take care.